cylindrically consistent dynamics. Bianca?
Yeah. Good morning, and thank you, Jorge, for organizing this seminar series. So I will talk about coarse graining, and I will argue that this is actually a very nice way to define a cylindrically consistent dynamics in the form of transition amplitudes and Hamilton's principal function. So we have the overview on slide 2, and I will start with a short motivation and actually a summary of this procedure. And then we will go through two different schemes. One is for classical systems and another one for quantum system. And in between, we will formalize everything, and I will show how cylindrical consistency and embedding maps come up. And last, we will show how to apply these formalisms to the spin form, in particular the so-called spin net case. And spin net are kind of simplified analog models for spin forms, which might already tell us about how spin forms might behave. And this is due to collaboration and discussions with a number of people. And I hope I didn't forget anyone. So on slide 3, I provide a short motivation. Why should we coarse-grain spin forms? Coarse-graining in general tries to extract the effective dynamics of the regime with many building blocks. And usually it's the same as the large-scale regime, of course, for gravity, since the scale is one variable of your system. It is, you can discuss that, and we can discuss it at the end. The important question for spin forms, actually, or to validate spin forms, is whether these models lead to a phase describing 4D smooth manifolds on macroscopic scales. And for instance, one particular issue one has to think about is that spin forms are more or less generalized lattice gauge theories. And standard non-abelian lattice gauge theories in 4D, for instance, are believed to be confining in the confining phase. And this confining phase actually corresponds to a phase where, if you interpret that as a spin form, degenerate geometry is completely dominate. So this would, for instance, question whether you get really some extended 4D geometry. Another question which you can ask is whether you have metric degrees of freedom at all scales. If you start with microscopic metric degrees of freedom, do you get macroscopic metric degrees of freedom with our procedures or not? As you probably know, long for some time, I'm interested in the restoration of diffeomorphism invariants or the triangulation or lattice independence. And basically, that is believed to appear under coarse graining. Another very recent result basically questions or brings up the possibility that this large scale limit for gravity is not just the equal, is not just given by the large J limit, and keeping basically just a few building blocks for spin forms. And this is due to the recent papers by Frank, Wojtek, and Claudio. And last but not least, coarse graining can be used to define, for instance, dynamics for homogeneous models and so on. So if there are no questions, I go on to slide 4, which basically just gives a very short summary, what does coarse graining mean? And coarse graining just means that you split your state sum into two different pieces. And the state sum is usually given as a sum over some variables, which are here called psi, and they represent all the microscopic or fine degrees of freedom. And your model is usually given by specifying some amplitude function, which depends on these microscopic degrees of freedom. Now what you have to do is to think of a way to summarize these fine fields into some coarse grain field. And you split basically your variables into finer fields and coarser fields, and you sum over the finer fields. So these finer, you can rewrite that as a condition that you sum over all variables, all finer variables, such that some conditions, some blocking conditions, is satisfied, giving you the coarse grain fields. And then in the end, you have still to sum over the coarse field variables. So basically you split the sum into these two pieces and perform one piece of the sum. And this defines you already the effective amplitude, which basically is effective because it includes the dynamics of your freedom. And if you do that basically slice by slice, you get a renormalization flow in every step going from A to A prime and taking this A prime as your original amplitude function again, possibly with some rescaling involved. If you do that, this is a very general procedure, but then to do that, you have to specify lots of things. One question which so far was not really, for some time, was not systematically investigated, but it basically depends on how ingenious you are, is how do you block actually the finer variables into coarser ones, because there are basically many possibilities and the results might change under choosing your blocking. Another important question is that, of course, you can never do that exactly. If you do that, basically what will happen with non-trivial models, you always flow in an infinite dimensional space of models, so you have first to find some parameterization for basically your amplitude function. And coarse graining usually leads to infinitely many non-local couplings, so you have to think to extract the relevant couplings and to truncate to some finite dimensional space of models. And so the other question is, how do you truncate this flow back to this finite dimensional space of models? Another point is how to deal with non-local couplings, which for a long time was basically the main problem in real space coarse graining, and the reason why real space coarse graining was not much discussed, except in a local truncation. And the important point here is basically the question, what do you do with your boundary? What happens if you have a boundary in your system? And we will see that everything can be more or less reduced to considering the boundary of the region and to actually coarse grain the boundary. And this is related to the question, you know, should we require some sort of triangulation independence for the boundary, not only for the bulk? Okay. Are there questions here? Okay, I go on to slide 5. So what I will show is that some methods which were recently developed in condensed matter and quantum information, which go under the broad framework of tensor network renormalization, provide answers to all these questions. And in this talk, I will basically present the procedure for classical systems, where blocking and truncation is chosen by hand, and the procedure for quantum system, where this blocking and truncation is chosen dynamically, is determined by the dynamics of the system. And first, I will actually summarize shortly the method, and then go over to the classical part. So I'm on slide 7 now. And the nice thing is that one can basically reinterpret this formalism with things which we already love in our community, and that is a generalized boundary formalism, which was introduced by Oeckel. So we see actually our state sum model as a method to associate amplitudes to space-time regions with a given boundary. So given some space-time boundary, some space-time region, we can integrate out all bulk variables and get some amplitude function which just depends on our boundary variables. And that is basically shown in the left panel. And the boundary variables are represented by the blue short lines, and basically the box represents all what is inside this boundary, what is inside the bulk and summation over the bulk variables. So as we know, we have to deal with this amplitude function, which basically represents all the what is happening in the bulk, and we have to integrate that against a boundary wave function, which basically represents the state which comes from outside this region. And so we need, for the boundary wave function, we of course need as many variables as we have our amplitude depending on. So in this case, we have also four variables, which are again represented by the blue lines here. And this red dotted line represents just the boundary wave function. And if we pair the amplitude function with our boundary wave function, we basically get our transition amplitude, which is basically also a generalized transition amplitude, because there's just one state involved, by just integrating one thing against the other thing. So we can see our amplitude function as an antilinear functional on our boundary Hilbert space, H1, and this boundary wave function lives in our boundary Hilbert space, H1. Okay. Are there any questions so far? Somebody still there?
We are there.
Yes, we're here. Marseille is still here.
I'm saying, so this is space-time because it's a partition function. No, this is all with a general, with the formalism of generalized boundaries where at the moment you don't care. So this is of course Euclidean, but in general you could apply it to Lorentzian spin forms. It's a question what happens in this case. But in general it would apply also to this case, to space time. So now basically we just coarse-grained space-time regions, and so how do we calculate the amplitude function for a larger region? We just put four or a certain number of these smaller regions together and integrate over the common boundary variables, and this is nicely represented again by just these blue lines, and these blue lines more or less always represent now an integration over the variables. And basically a summation on the Hilbert space. If you do that, you immediately see that this new amplitude function now acts on the boundary Hilbert space, which carries more variables, so it has a higher dimension, if we are in finite dimensional case. But you want to compare that with basically the original amplitude function, because you want to define a flow. And this original amplitude function was acting on a Hilbert space with a smaller dimension. So in many cases, you might have to rescale. Actually, this is not really necessary for gravity or reparametrization invariant systems because the scaling is already in the variables. So what you basically see here is that you need some way to compare A prime with A. You need some way to relate the coarser and the finer boundary Hilbert spaces by embedding maps. And assume you have given such an embedding, so an embedding of basically the Hilbert space H1 into H2, you can actually define a flow, and this is shown in the picture on pictures on slide 9. So you basically compute your coarse-grained amplitude, which corresponds to taking four of these basic building blocks together and gluing them together. You use your embedding to compare this to extract basically the effective amplitude A prime, which just acts on the original Hilbert space. And this can be used to define A prime just as original functional on your original boundary Hilbert space. And this you can iterate and find the fixed point for this procedure. So this finishes basically the general method. And if there are no questions, I go to the classical procedure, which is here for the 2D scalar field. So let's go to slide 11. And so far I was speaking about the quantum case where we have to deal with the amplitude functional. In the classical case, we have Hamilton's principal function, which is basically replaces this amplitude functional. And this is just the action evaluated on solutions depending on boundary data. And actually, first you have to start with a given discretization, and this procedure, it doesn't really depend, you know, on which particular discretization you choose, because the fixed points will more or less be independent of this choice. And a discrete action is actually already a first guess of Hamilton's principal function for your basic building blocks, and they depend, however, on the discretization of your boundary data. Whereas basically you want to try to find Hamilton's principal function of your continuum theory. So we in this example, we will consider basically squares as basic building blocks. And on the squares, you will have four boundary data to start with. So you associate the scalar field psi to the vertices of your square. And we are considering, for simplicity, the action for massless free scalar field, which in this case is just this given function, and I'm also in the Euclidean spacetime, basically 2D spacetime. And I'm afraid it's completely wrong, because there should be some minus signs. So everything in the middle in the brackets is a minus sign. So here's the iteration procedure. You start with your original discrete action on the square. So it's just, in this case, some quadratic function depending on four variables. Now you glue four of these squares together to a bigger square. And you immediately see that you, of course, get more boundary data. And nevertheless, you can basically, by integrating out or by solving for the vertex in the middle, you can find Hamilton's principal function for depending now on 8 boundary data. And this is a point where you have to choose something. You have to tell the theory how to go back to some function depending on 4 data. And usually you do that by pullback of some embedding map. And here we have chosen the piecewise linear embedding for different reasons. It turns out to actually lead to a good approximation. And this piecewise linear embedding just means that, in this case, it's edgewise linear embedding. We replace our boundary fields in the middle of the edges. So this is phi 1, 2, and phi 2, 3, and phi 3, 4, and so on, by the average of the endpoints of the edges. So phi 1, 2 is given by 1/2 of phi 1 and phi 2 and so on. So along the edges, the field is just piecewise linear. And using this embedding map, we can just pull back our action, or our Hamilton's principal function, depending on 8 data, to some function which just depends on the 4 data, namely the 4 original data sitting on the vertices of your square. So this will give you a new function, and since we just considered some quadratic functional, the flow stays closed inside the quadratic functions of 4 variables, and we can just go on and iterate again and again, and we will just find some flow and some fixed point. So here's basically flow, the general parameterization turns out to so the flow just happens in one parameter, alpha, and this alpha basically introduces non-local couplings between the 4 fields on the square, which have not been there before. So non-local just means that you also get diagonal couplings between psi 1, psi 3, and psi 2, and psi 4. And you get basically a coupling which involves all of these 4 fields. And the fixed point is just given by basically if this alpha is equal to 2/3. So my claim is actually, as it will turn out later, this will be actually already the continuum result, and this is kind of exceptional in this case. This is the continuum Hamilton's principal function for a square with piecewise linear boundary data, and piecewise linear boundary data is basically a concept which you also can define in the continuum. So we have found a continuum result for a simple kind of boundary data in the continuum.
Bianca, in your in the final expression for S4 prime, of course you have alpha, But if I go to the right-hand side of your transparency, there also you've got S4 prime explicitly written in terms of S8.
Yeah. And so then there is... The plus signs, I think these are actually minus signs. So the plus signs
But I'm just wondering about alpha, because on the right hand column, S4 prime is written in terms of S8 prime, which in terms of S8, and there is no alpha there anywhere.
Ah, because alpha in every step is just a number which I haven't given there explicitly.
So somewhere.
So alpha in the beginning, alpha is zero. You know, in the next step, it is something. I forgot, like 1/3 or something. But I haven't put alpha explicitly there. I could have put alpha there.
Okay, so alpha is there in that somewhere in that formula on the right hand side. Okay, thank you.
I haven't put it there explicitly.
So, but what is the origin of this alpha? Is it, for instance, you have freedom when you define, for instance, phi 1/2 instead of putting 1/2 there, you put something else? Is that the origin?
So, what is the origin of alpha?
Because, as Abhay said, I mean, as you wrote it on the right, there was no alpha; it was a fixed number. But now you're saying, well, that could have been a parameter.
You just see, I mean, you can do this calculation. You start with basically the action which where alpha is zero. And what happens is that new couplings are, under coarse-graining, you always get new couplings between these fields. So this term in the last bracket represents all the new couplings. And it happens that you can basically isolate just this into one term. So you rather have to ask where are these non-local couplings come or these new couplings coming from, and this is just the case that the continuum Hamilton functions is a more generalized function than the discrete action you started with.
Okay.
So the discrete action you started with the simplest choice to get basically the discretization of the Laplacian, and the continuum result basically introduces all kinds of couplings. And this will continue throughout, the procedure as we will see later. So what happens is that in these quadratic examples and also in the higher, in the nonlinear ones, all kinds of couplings are generated. Okay, does it answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
So this is an iteration procedure, and it just, you just iterate between one square and then the square glued from four squares, but you can try to determine what have you actually done. And basically we have first taken one square, glued four of these together, and then taken that as a new effective square and again glued four of them together. So on slide 13, it depicts a bit of the approximation which you are doing if you find this effective action or the fixed point here. So we have basically lots of these basic squares and glued to a bigger square. And for this example, I've basically color-coded in which cases, for which vertices, you have solved the field exactly. So this is the case for the yellow dots. And then you basically approximated the fields in the first round of approximation in the light blue dots. So approximated means that there you have actually put these fields equal to the piecewise linear condition. And in the darker blue dots, you basically approximated the fields in the second iteration. And in the very blue dots, which only occur in the boundary, you again use just the piecewise linear embedding maps. So the red dots still represent your free data. So you have basically still the four free boundary data. But here you see, even if you have a fixed point, in general you cannot expect that this is already the continuum result, because you computed Hamilton's principal function within some approximation. And within some approximation appears basically also in the bulk. So we have to expect some corrections. And this approximation, again, is determined by the embedding map. So the embedding map basically will tell you what to do with the boundary, and it also defines the truncation or the approximation you are doing in the bulk. So usually the fixed point will be some approximation to the continuum Hamilton's function evaluated on the special edgewise linear boundary data. And, I already mentioned that for free massless scalar field, this approximation turns out to be exact, and we will see how we can say that. but the same procedure for squares, if you do the same procedure starting with the more complicated squares and iterate this one, it will give us corrections to this approximation. And this we consider basically on the next slide, 14.
So
you can basically do the completely same thing. However, now you start with a building block, which carries just more boundary data.
I think there was a question somewhere.
Yeah, if you can go back to 13 for a minute. These yellow dots, which are supposed to be equations of motions that have been solved, but in the previous transparency, where you are showing us this procedure, you did not solve any equation of motion, is it? Or what did you do there?
In the second picture on slide 12, I glue four of these squares together. I glue four squares together, and I get an inner vertex.
Yeah.
And there's a psi zero or phi zero, and that's where I solve the equation of motion. So I put this phi zero equal to the solution of the equation of motion. So you get one equation of motion in this case, which you solve in every step.
So this is the equation of motion you would get using just phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4. Is that it?
So you get an equation of motion, which depends, you know, and you have to solve psi 0 as a function of your boundary variables. And since you can basically do that, you can also do that by putting first all these additional boundary fields to the piecewise linear condition, and then it just depends on psi 1 to psi 4.
Okay. And the next question was that on transparency 13 again, where is the, I mean, you already told us what the this procedure gives you, a fixed point and so on. Mm-hmm. So what is it that we're doing by embedding in this classical pitch theory? I'm not clear about that. Can you explain to us again what you're doing with the embedding map?
With the embedding map?
Yeah.
So the embedding map is needed, I mean, on slide 12, is needed to basically pull back the Hamilton's principal function as a function of 8 boundary data to Hamilton's principal function of 4 data.
Okay, so, but that is something that you already did on the last step in this transparency, right?
So now I do here. So here I need that to define basically really a closed renormalization flow.
Right.
So I can take this as my new discrete action.
Right.
And do this procedure again. If I wouldn't do that, I basically would have to do the continuum, the full calculation, and I would get more and more boundary data in every step, and I would have to solve for more and more bulk variable for more and more bulk variables in every step.
So at each step, when you get something like S4 prime, then you've already done the embedding map, right?
Then I already have used the embedding map, yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Can I continue a question on this direction, Bianca?
Yeah.
Is the embedding map somehow chosen to agree with the equation of motion somehow?
This would be ingenious if you could do that. So I've chosen this piecewise linear embedding map because it actually is very nice if you consider triangles and you get already some invariance for the 3-1 partner move. And I will come back to that later. And in the quantum case, it will be much more important to choose the embedding map according to the dynamics of the system. So here I've chosen piecewise linear. And indeed, the corrections which we will get at higher order, they all come from the fact that piecewise linear does not agree with the solution in the bulk. But actually, I will have a slide later on.
Okay.
Thanks for this question. So now I'm on slide 14. And this should just give you an understanding that you have performed this calculation, you have found a fixed point for the square with 4 boundary data in a given approximation. And the nice thing about this procedure is that you can always check how good is this approximation by going to a more complicated calculation. And this more more complicated calculation just involves to using more refined boundary data. So the idea here is that instead of, you know, using the same building block, you just define your building block, which of course is very natural in loop quantum gravity. Just, you know, just for instance, kind of means you need higher valence vertices. So in this case, we start with a building block which has 8 boundary data, and so you actually just allow to have basically kinks in the middle of your edges. And I make a little variable transformation. So instead of just having the field associated to the midpoints of the edges, phi, 1, 2, I introduce the deviation from piecewise linearity, which will be called gamma. So the embedding map now would be just to put gamma to 0. And I can do the same procedure again. And I would, of course, get, after basically putting 4 of these more complicated squares together, I get again more boundary data. And I use basically the embedding map, putting these additional gammas to 0, again to pull back the action to the, such that it only depends on the original number of variables. And I find basically some fixed point action in the end. And on slide 14, basically, I have given the fixed point action in this case, so S8, which now depends on 8 boundary variables. And here you actually get this, that this S8 has one piece, which just depends on the psi, on the phi fields. And it's actually the same as we found for the iteration procedure with the simple squares. And this actually shows you that this simple square example gave you already the continuum result. But I will also later tell you that it is a continuum result because you can actually find the continuum solution, the continuum equation of motion for this case. And then you get some additional terms, which are just couplings between the phi and gamma fields, and terms which are just the gamma fields. So going this way, we can basically find Hamilton's function for more and more refined boundary data. And in this case, it's easy to compare these different actions for different fixed point actions for more and more complicated boundary data, because we can just put these additional deviation fields to 0. So if you go to slide 15, I summarize basically what happens if you go to squares with 16 boundary variables. And in this case, you have gamma fields, which basically give you the first deviation, and you have kappa fields, which sit even on the more refined in between vertices, between the gamma fields and the psi fields and so on. And here you see actually that if you just consider the terms which basically give you the gamma fields, again, you know, you get a slight change in the numerical prefactors of these fields. But you see that the change is not very big, so you get already a good approximation. And if you would go on, it would basically converge hopefully to some definite number. And in S16, you basically get also additional terms, which are all the couplings between psi and kappa and gamma and kappa and so on. These are many, many terms in case, because what you in general get is couplings between all these variables. So basically all these additional kappa fields are coupled to each other and so on. So here the embedding maps, you know, you can actually apply the embedding maps on the fixed point actions to basically pull back, for instance, the fixed point action for 16 boundary data to the one with 8 boundary data. And that allows you to compare to check the convergence. And to check whether you are near the continuum result. And for that, again, we need to use embedding maps. Okay. So this finishes more or less the procedure. The classical procedure, if there are no further questions. Let's go to page 16. It just tells you that, in principle, you can also do that for a nonlinear potential, and you get a longish result because, again, you get couplings between all kinds of variables. And you can think of different procedures you can do. You can basically first, you can glue just 4 into 1 square. You can also glue 16 into 1 square. And if you go for the 16 to 1 square procedure, you get, of course, immediately a better approximation to the continuum result, which, however, doesn't really matter much if you're going to the more complicated building blocks anyway. So if you, for instance, include the gamma fields, which have been the first deviation from piecewise linearity, the coefficient, I just give one coefficient because you have many coefficients, at least this one doesn't change very much from the scheme from with four squares to the scheme with 16 squares. So you can decide what to do. In the scheme with 4 squares, you basically solve the equation of motion more efficiently. It's an easy exercise to figure that out. And what you get in the end is basically a better approximation to your Hamilton's principle function, which, however, you could also take as your fundamental discretization if you want to do that. So the...
Can you refocus on the right-hand side? I cannot read it.
It's not supposed to be readable.
Could you repeat the question, please?
What kind of terms are there?
Here's a question from PI, and this is what kind of terms you get on the right-hand side. And so I've chosen a truncation, actually. So in principle, you get all kinds of polynomials of arbitrary high order if you would do that. So my truncation...
You can, in principle, determine all those coefficients. In other words, can you determine a function, which is a function, if you wish, Hamilton function, which would be... at a fixed point.
So here again is a was question which I didn't fully understood.
So you have basically infinite many parameters. Oh. Sometimes they all apply in
fixed. So to the fixed point, yeah. So let me tell you what I've done in this calculation. I've done a truncation to couplings up to lambda square. And if you do this truncation, it automatically cuts to phi to the 6, I believe.
Yeah.
So then you can. And
the reason why I'm asking this is because I've done some calculations on what is the physical space, small group calculations, and you also get effective potential that contains all powers of the fields, but then you can resum it and you can represent it as a function.
Yeah, so basically here the question is whether you can resum all the polynomials, and I don't know the answer. So maybe you can derive some kind of recursion relation. This was some explicit calculation which I done on a computer because you cannot solve it analytically. So
sure, I understand.
So you have to put numbers.
I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying it's possible.
Maybe it's possible. We have to think about it. Okay.
You see, then you could study convergence, stuff like this,
Okay. So here is also a case where with a nonlinear potential, if you would not put some additional cutoff, you get infinitely many couplings because you get arbitrary high polynomials.
Well, the reason why I'm saying this is because this one-loop result that you actually derive in the SIBA actually contains infinitely many terms. However, they all vanish if the limit on t goes continuous.
Yeah.
So that is, for example, something that you could check whether it happens.
Yeah. I mean, here you could, you get basically infinitely many couplings.
Sure.
But many of these are very small. So you could truncate again if you want to apply that. But let me go on, because I'm also not sure whether everybody in the audience gets your questions.
You should repeat the questions.
Yeah. So as possible applications, you can basically, it's interesting to get basically improved discretization. And the general philosophy, as you can see at these examples, is to introduce more complicated or more complex building blocks. And you have still local couplings between building blocks, whereas previously usually what has been done is you keep simple building blocks, but in this case you get basically very complicated non-local couplings. So in a sense you can understand, you know, these additional boundary fields as additional variables which eat up your non-local couplings which you would get otherwise. So as I told you, you in principle can use that for numerical simulations to find better discretizations if you want to do numerical GR or something. And they lead to, if you take these boundary, the more complicated building blocks into account, you however have all kinds of couplings between the boundary fields of a given building block, which means that you get higher order difference equations. But as compared to previous schemes, in a controlled way. So this can be used basically to find perfect discretizations and to define the continuum limit. And again, the nice thing about it that you can actually control the number of couplings you get and the amount of non-locality. So this turns perfect discretization into a more definite process. Okay, so the next slide, which is slide 18, I just formalize it to cylindrical consistency, and I will be quite short on cylindrical consistency, assuming that many of you know what it is. So the first slide just tells you what the schematic is set up. So cylindrical consistency just means that you have a sequence or a family of spaces, in this case of configuration spaces, which have a partial order, so that you can embed these configuration spaces into each other. So in this case it's quite simple because the partial order is just actually some ordering, some usual ordering. And in the example we considered, these embeddings are given in this formula and are just representing putting piecewise linear boundary conditions onto your fields. There's a consistency relation which just tells you, you know, combining two embeddings gives you just the embedding between, an embedding between this two-step thing, between, for instance, a square with four boundary data and 16 boundary data. And as we know, so in this setup, if you have these embeddings, we can use that to define the continuum configuration space by an inductive limit. So what we should get is basically that if you have these embeddings and this family of configuration spaces, we can take the continuum limit via this method of using the inductive limit. So what would mean, so this is more or less the kinematical setup, but what we are actually asking for is now a functional or a family of functions, in this case Hamilton's principal function, which is cylindrically consistent. And cylindrical consistency for these functions just means that it doesn't matter where you evaluate your function, you get the same result for a given set of boundary data. So it doesn't mean where you basically, in which labeled configuration space you do this evaluation, as long as this labeled configuration space is basically large enough to answer the question you're asking. So a cylindrical consistent function would be just a function which behaves nicely under pullback with these embedding maps. And our approximation procedure is basically just given by this very abstract middle formula. We compute basically this S B prime B, which is basically Hamilton's function for a finer boundary computed from the fixed point action for the coarser boundary. And we pull that back with our embedding to the coarser boundary. So basically this represents a fixed point condition. So doing that for different kinds of boundaries, B, we might find different fixed point actions, However, if our computation or our fixed-point action does not depend on the choice of finer boundary, we actually find a continuum result. So this is what happened in the first step in the massless free scalar field, that this first piece remained constant. So here we have basically a cylindrical consistent Hamilton's function, which defines your cylindrical consistent dynamics. And it gives you basically continuum results for discrete boundary data. However, these discrete boundary data can just be interpreted as special continuum boundary data. Okay, and again, this concept can be easily generalized to the quantum case, because in this case, you again just take replace configuration spaces by boundary Hilbert spaces, and it's exactly the same thing as before. Hamilton's function is replaced by the amplitude map, and again, you would require basically cylindrical consistency or the fixed point amplitude by the same equation. So if you want to do it for quantum theory, we can say that a cylindrical consistent amplitude map defines you a cylindrical consistent dynamics inside for your quantum theory. Again, it would basically give you a continuum result in case you find that for boundary data which have a discrete flavor, but which would represent continuum boundary data. And that is more or less also the principle in loop quantum gravity. So let me comment here now on the choice of embeddings, and that is related also to Carlos' question. So in the classical case, we have chosen the embedding by hand. And actually, this really determines the quality of the approximation. So in the paper, which was cited, I've also tried some other embedding map, which doesn't work so well, which was actually the piecewise constant embedding map. So this embedding map, I mean, even better would be to adjust it to the dynamics of the system, which we will actually do in the quantum case. And the ideal case is that the embedding indeed reproduces the behavior of the solution along the inner boundaries. So in this simple example of the massless scalar field, you can check if you consider basically a square built out of 16 squares and consider basically piecewise, again, edgewise linear boundary data, what happens with the solution? You compute the solution on all the vertices, on all the inner vertices, and this solution again will be piecewise linear on these inner edges. So indeed, in this case, you know, you can actually find the continuum solution. I mean, I did. I wrote it in the paper, but not here. Sorry. And this again, the continuum solution is indeed piecewise linear inside this square. So if you choose some embedding which is very near the behavior of your solution already in the bulk for this given kind of boundary data you have, so there's an interplay between choosing, you know, the coarse graining of your boundary data and the behavior of your solution, you get a good approximation. So this coarse graining, actually, this choice of embeddings is even more crucial in the quantum theory, because if you just choose a random embedding map in the quantum theory, you get a completely very bad approximation, or you even don't find a fixed point. And again, you can find an example in the paper. Of mine. However, luckily, there is a formalism where basically this choosing the embedding is already implemented, and that goes under the name of tensor network algorithm. And what we are going to do here is again to reinterpret a bit these tensor network algorithm into our language, and these were basically developed in condensed matter and quantum information theory in the last couple of years.
Hi, Bianca. Can you just give us some intuition? So, in a sense, for a given dynamics, let's say a given potential, then there's an adapted embedding map, and these tensor networks allow?
I mean, you could try to find an adapted embedding map, which I didn't spend much time on thinking about. So there might be some procedure for the classical case also to choose some adapted embedding map. So I will just tell you now how you choose embedding map in the quantum procedure. So I've chosen piecewise linear, for instance, because that is quite natural to choose for a scalar field, and at least on small scales, you don't expect large deviations from piecewise linear.
For a scalar field or for a free scalar field, in a sense, is it the dynamics that tells you which type of embedding map you should choose, or not at all?
So I've chosen piecewise linear also for the nonlinear case. You know, and then what happens is that you don't find the continuum result with a low number of these boundary fields, but you nevertheless find convergence if you basically improve your approximation. So in the classical case, as long as you choose your embedding map, somehow adapted to the dynamics in the sense that piecewise linear, even for a non-linear field, is good and will give you good results as long as as the scales involved, you have still to discretize on a scale where basically your solution behaves piecewise linear from one vertex to the next. Okay. But in the quantum case, we will have a simple procedure to find these embedding maps. So let me go to slide 23. And this is more or less motivated by the transfer operator technique, which is a standard technique in statistical systems to solve state sum models. So in this case, we go back actually to the not generalized boundary proposal. So we consider basically the standard situation that you have just a time slicing or time direction, and you have two boundary states or a boundary state put into two pieces. So you have standard transition amplitudes between two states, which, however, are again, this amplitude function is again just given by the standard amplitude, and is basically depicted in the first panel. Now, what you can do is you have basically these two time steps. You can introduce a resolution of identity, which you can again basically put into the language of boundary states between time step one and time step two. And that basically defines your transfer operator. And so your amplitude function in this case would be just given as the transfer operator to the power of n in case you have n time steps. And in this case, you just have two time steps. But if you make n large, you see that if you can diagonalize the transfer operator, only the state with the largest eigenvalue will dominate. So indeed, that's what people usually do. They truncate, or they just restrict to the vacuum case by restricting this sum basically to the eigenvectors of t with the chi largest eigenvalues. So chi would basically define you some kind of cutoff. And the smallness of the eigenvalues which you throw away in this truncation tell you how good this truncation is.
In that case.
Sorry?
T is not a unitary operator in that case. Oh.
T is not, if you truncate, T in general would be a unitary operator.
So it's the eigenvalue have a modulus 1.
So this is for statistics, you are right. So this is for statistical systems, yeah.
So it's not the unitary operator.
This has to be seen for Euclidean systems, where you can compare the eigenvalues.
So you're sort of looking at the vacuum of the system in the
yeah.
E to the n for log n.
Yeah. So this is big rotated.
Okay.
So this defines your truncation. And in general, so you expect a good approximation of your transition amplitudes if psi 1 and psi 2 are actually in span of these eigenvectors. But in general, now if you go for a larger system, the explicit diagonalization of your transfer operator becomes very difficult to impossible. So you can actually try something different and localize your truncations by diagonalizing only subparts of your transfer operator. And that is really depicted on page 24. So if we go, you know, we have on the first picture, we just have the original situation that we diagonalize the full transfer operator. But instead, we can always pick out two of these and find some way to truncate to some eigenvalues or some generalized eigenvalues of basically always pairs of these amplitude boxes. And this would again define an iteration procedure. If you take one pair and basically contract that and find with these embedding maps a new effective amplitude, A prime, we can use that again to define a new transfer operator to do basically the same game, and that gives us embedding maps at different levels of iterations. So here is what's happening. These blue three-valent vertices are basically the embedding maps in one direction between a given Hilbert space and typically a tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces. Which again we can determine by actually some generalized eigenvalue decomposition, which is just actually singular value decomposition, where the eigenvalues are all positive, roughly. And in one direction, from the right to the left, it is an embedding. From the left to the right, you can actually see that as a blocking of your variables. So basically, the embedding map after three iterations looks a bit like shown on the last picture there on page 24. So let's go to some example. That is the easy model because it's very simple. And there's just a short explanation that we can rewrite the easy model easily into these kind of models. So in the easing model, you have basically group elements. It works as a group Z2. You have group elements plus minus 1. And the entire dynamics is described by edge weight omega. If you do Fourier transformation, you go to the spin representation, which is well known, and you get basically something which now looks a bit different, because instead of variables associated to the vertices, you get variables associated to the edges. These are representation labels, and you get also Gauss constraint, which comes just from this global symmetry you have. So what you should just get out of here is that you can rewrite the easing model into this kind of amplitude function with the little box and four outer variables, which are just given by these representation labels, which just take values 0 and 1. And doing that, we can go to page 26 and really try to find our embedding maps with this procedure. So we basically take this complex out of two boxes and diagonalize this complex. This diagonalization will give us basically two eigenvectors. And we pick the one with the largest eigenvalue. So we get embedding maps which go from C2 to C2 times T2. Now this kind of embedding maps, because you do basically this diagonalization, gives you as a result always embedding maps which satisfies this condition on the right-hand side. Namely, if you glue two of these embedding maps together, you get just the identity. So in this case, we can easily parameterize our embedding maps as is shown in the left corner below. The condition basically turns two of these numbers which we have, namely the transition from state 1 to 0, 1 or state 1 to 1, 0 into fixed numbers, namely 1 over square root of 2. And we have only one free parameter, alpha, which describes whether 0 is mapped to 0, 0 or 0 is mapped to 1, 1. And we just have these four numbers because also on the three-valent vertices, we have the Gauss constraint. The Gauss constraint needs to be satisfied. That is, the number of representation labels meeting there needs to be zero. Needs to be a trivial representation. So actually, the high temperature phase, so the, this is the symmetric phase, is just given by alpha equal to zero. So that means that the very left panel is dominating, so zero will be always mapped to zero, zero, which is kind of logical. This is basically what we use in loop quantum gravity, the more or less the Arshtika-Lewandowski embedding, that if you have a zero, we refine that by basically putting J, our representation label J, again to zero. And the low temperature phase is basically the frozen phase with the symmetry broken phase. And in this case, the other term would dominate. The sine of alpha would be 1, and 0 would be always mapped to 1, 1. Or to, sorry, to 1 square root of 2. Okay, so if you go to page 27, we get actually, we will depict some numerical results in which show you how this angle alpha changes with the number of iterations, starting with different initial conditions or with different initial edge weights. So in the left diagram, you know, I've gone through initial conditions which are widely spread, and you see that very fast you go either to basically alpha equal to zero or alpha equal to 0.7 something, which represents the low temperature phase. But you also see basically alpha is now, that alpha now changes with the number of iterations. So you truly have something, an embedding map which changes with each iteration step. On the right-hand side, you know, I've chosen initial values which are much nearer the phase transition temperature. So in this case, you are very near the phase transition, and you see that the nearer you are to the phase transition, the longer you get a certain plateau where alpha is almost constant. But in the end, you always actually go either to low temperature or high temperature phase, which just means that this is the second order phase transition where your fixed point is unstable. And actually this plateau of almost constant alpha defines you the scale-free dynamics which you get in the case of sitting exactly on the phase transition. So here we have basically embeddings which are determined by the dynamics of the system. It's actually a very crude approximation, and there are much better methods now in condensed matter, which I'm not going to explain. And in a sense, you can say these embeddings represent the physical vacuum for the finer degrees of freedom in this case. Okay.
So in this plot on the right-hand side, what are the color codings? I didn't understand that. You start in the same, you know, somewhere near the critical point, and then you are actually...
Yeah, so the different...
So what are the various...
The different colors represent the different initial conditions.
Ah, so they are very close to the critical point.
Close to the boundary. Yeah, so we run from this 0.59515 to this 1.8. So...
Thank you.
It's near the phase transition temperature.
Right. So slight differences make a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and the farther, I didn't explain that. So the farther you are out to the right, so the longer the plateau, that means you are nearer to the phase transition.
Thank you.
So basically this is... this is the basic idea of how you could determine the embedding maps. I mean, this is one method. There are other methods out here, and this is a very simple-minded method. On page 28, you can see how to apply that if you have really a 2D state sum model. In this case, we go basically back to our generalized boundary proposal and look for, have basically this wave function just sitting on one boundary, piece of the boundary. So you can come up also with an iteration step and find basically this embedding map with some generalized eigenvalue decomposition principle. And you again can basically extract these embedding maps, which are now needed to compare results for different approximations. And these different approximations are labeled by the so-called bond dimension. And this bond dimension is just the size of the Hilbert space you associate to the blue lines. And if, you know, if this comparison converges as in the same way as for the classical systems, we actually define a continuum limit. So that defines, kind of gives you an idea of the 2D method. There are many different methods out here, and the actual method which we apply at the moment looks a bit different. But I'm not going to comment here. So I have more or less three slides left, which try shortly to explain it to what the application of this is and what we are doing now. And the plan is, or what we are currently doing, is applying that to spinnets. And let me just tell you shortly what spinnets are. These are basically analog models of spin foams. And the entire difficulty of coarse graining is that it typically becomes much harder in higher dimensions. And these methods at the moment are kind of controlled in two dimensions, but not so much in higher dimensions. So the nice thing about spin nets is that they are non-trivial in two dimensions, whereas spin foams are not very much interesting in two dimensions. Here I just explain shortly the holonomy formulation, which we come up with together with Benjamin, Frank, and Wojtek in a recent paper. And this holonomy formulation is nice because it just shows you that spin foams are a generalized lattice gauge theory. And the general procedure from going from spin foams to spin nets is that everything what was based in spin foams, for instance, on a face, is for spin nets based on an edge. Everything what is based on an edge is now based on a vertex, and so on. So if we have a group element associated to every edge in the spin form, we associate it to the vertices in the spin net case. And this holds also for group elements associated to pairs, which happens to be the case for the holonomy formulation, and so on. So the one thing, I don't think that if you haven't seen it before, you get it now, what the details of this formulation is. The nice thing of this parameterization, however, is that it nicely picks out the one dynamical ingredient in spin forms, namely the simplicity constraints. So basically there's this one function E which parameterizes your possibilities to take the simplicity constraints. And so this parameterization, if you choose E, this function E correctly, covers basically standard models such as Barrett-Crane, EPRL, and FK, and Baratang, Orite, and so on. So you make one assumption, and that is a certain factorization property of your simplicity constraints, which holds for all these models, but doesn't hold for the Polish model. And basically on the right-hand side, you see that we can write exactly the same models for the spin net case. So we also have simplicity constraints there. The other nice thing about the holonomy formulation is that we can easily generalize that to other groups, like finite groups, which is kind of important if you want to do this kind of numerics. So what we are doing now is, if you go to page 30, it basically, again, motivates to consider the spin net case. Another important motivation for us to consider spin nets is actually that the experience from lattice gauge theory is that there is a certain correspondence between 4D models and 2D models, namely that statistical properties between 4D models and corresponding 2D models are very similar. And it's a standard technique in lattice gauge theories to discuss, for instance, confinement and these things in corresponding 2D models. In this case, so it's a bit unclear whether this holds for spin forms and spin nets, but nevertheless, we can basically probe the behavior of simplicity constraints under coarse graining for these spin nets, and in particular, studying embedding maps for the transfer operator. Again, in a recent paper, we have shown that this transfer operator nicely incorporates also the simplicity constraints because it splits again into projectors on the simplicity constraints and an in-between piece omega. So doing this exercise, we can extract basically what kind of blocking is implemented by the dynamics of spin nets. In this case, is this blocking geometrically meaningful? No, are the simplicity constraints relaxed under coarse graining or are they strengthened and so on? And this will help us to understand the dynamics of spin forms. And I guess that is more or less the main question which we have on the spin forms. Okay. So what we have done at some point actually last year is to study abelian spin net models which don't really feature non-trivial simplicity constraints, but in this paper you can basically find the method, a good explanation of the method. What we are doing now and what is currently running is basically models based on the permutation group S3, which feature non-trivial simplicity constraints. And in the future, we plan to study SU2 quantum group models. And in general, I think it's worthwhile to investigate the interplay between these embedding maps and truncation for analytical investigations and possibly also for the SU2 case. Okay, and that was actually page 31, which I forgot to announce. The last slide just summarizes again that we get all the answers to the questions we were asking in the beginning. So how to block finer variables into coarser one? This is more or less given by the embedding maps. If you take the embedding maps and read it backwards, we get a blocking. What is the space of models the normalization flow takes place in? This is also more or less defined by the embedding maps because in the end, these models which I gave you or where this tensor network renormalization takes place in, it's not very surprisingly, they are called tensor models. So basically it's just this general idea of putting everything into a big vertex. How to truncate the flow back to the space? Again, this is given by the embedding map, which also provide you the truncation. The non-local couplings are, you know, converted into more variables because that is more or less the size of the Hilbert space of in these blue edges. And how to coarse grain the boundary? Indeed, what we have to choose is not so much a coarse graining of the boundary, but an embedding of your boundary variables into each other, of your boundary Hilbert spaces into each other. And actually, in this way, using the embedding map, you can also require a kind of discretization independence for your boundary, not only for your bulk, but also for your boundary, because again, that is done by using the embedding maps. And that closes my talk on page 33.
Questions?
Question from Marseille. Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, I...
If you apply these ideas to theories that are non-trivial but we know well, like QCD or even QED, do you get something? What?
So these methods, they work well in two dimensions. And they work, yeah, so for the easy model, you know, you can compute to arbitrary precision and people apply it too strongly. In general, they apply it for strongly correlated systems quite successfully now in two and slowly in three dimensions and so on. So what is a bit more difficult, or what is a good question, is how to do that for things which would require like Lie groups, SU2. It might be even easier to do it for QCD. The difficulty for spin forms is that basically if we do it for spin forms, then the BS case corresponds to a case where we would need already for SU2 an infinite bond dimension. And that is a certain difficulty which one has to deal with at some point. So that's why we would like to consider quantum groups, because in this case we just have finite bond dimension. So for QCD, these methods have not been applied because it's basically that the problem is that the approximation still is not good enough to, is not strong enough to give you a doable calculation in four dimensions. But the plan of these people is to apply to QCD at some point.
And is there a reason to expect that it's easier in gravity than in, say, QCD, or not?
Yeah, I mean, the actually what my plan is to study the embedding maps and find maybe some reason why these embedding maps might, you know, not change so much. And then it might be easier for gravity. So that's basically from a complete spin form perspective, it's a bit harder because to get reliable results, you have to represent the BS fixed point in your state space, in your phase space. And this BS fixed point requires basically this infinite bond dimension. And if you don't do that, so if you apply there's a technical reason, if you would do heat kernel, for instance, heat kernel regularization or a cutoff, then what you should expect from lattice gauge theory, if you put a heat kernel, it always flows back to the confining phase, which in geometrical terms for us means the degenerate phase. So this is a bit dangerous to get reliable results.
I want to continue along the same lines. One could just try QUD, right? I mean, where the group is just abelian, just U1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did that actually. I mean, we did abelian groups in the paper in 2011.
Okay, so then the key question then for me is really the following: that we knew from the older work that if you just look at the cylindrical consistency and so on, then ultimately you'll get a Hilbert space, which looks very different from Fock space.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you presumably find the same thing. And so the question is really, what is the relation between between something that one normally believes, right? I'm just talking about, pre-QED.
So if you actually U1 lattice gauge theory is very different from U1 continuum theory. So I think that might be related to this case. U1 gauge theory, lattice gauge theory, is not a free theory. And basically you have two phases. You have the confining phase and the deconfined phase. And the confining phase, let me see. The confining phase is basically the strong coupling which is not represented at all in the Fock space, in a continuum result. And the deconfined phase, I think, is around BF and would be basically the free theory. So in a sense, you would rather find the lattice gauge theory of U1, and this is very different from the continuum Fock space quantization.
But then again, I mean, you started by saying that, well, one of the questions is whether one has confined phase and such things. So I think there should be some way to get the standard Fock the Coulomb phase, right?
The Coulomb phase. Yeah. No. This would be basically represented by one phase. If you are in the deconfined phase.
But the question is in the inductive limit. How do you distinguish between the two things, and how do you get it? So, do we understand any of that?
Yeah, and this, I guess, again, that this is related to how you choose your embedding maps.
Exactly. So, I mean, when we looked at it many years ago, right?
Yeah, in this example with the easing model, you know, you basically have, if alpha is, let me think, if alpha is zero, which is the standard loop from gravity embedding, because zero is mapped to zero, zero. In this case, you actually at high temperature, which corresponds actually to the confining phase. So you are very, very much away from Fock space. And to get to the other phase, which would be the Coulomb phase, or in this case low temperature, we have to choose a different embedding map. So this might be related to the choice of embedding map. And indeed, if you want to represent BF effectively, you should basically choose an embedding map which is adjusted to the BF dynamics. And that would correspond to this angle alpha being T-force. So where actually zero is this equal probability mapped to 0, 0 and 1, 1.
I think
so it's a more non-trivial embedding map.
Right, but it'll be very interesting if in fact such a map exists, because the older work that was done, I don't know, almost not quite 10 years, but 8 years ago with UNQED and so on, that suggested strongly that in fact you would not have cylindrical consistency if you wanted to get, you wanted to recover the standard Fock, the standard Coulomb phase. That there had to be notions which was a little more complicated, but more sophisticated. It had to do with approximate cylindrical consistency.
Yeah. I made some comments actually in the conclusion of this paper, and indeed, one interesting thing is there some, can one write an embedding map really which is adjusted to the BF dynamics? Because the embedding map which we usually use in loop-com gravity is the other extreme from the BF case. You know, so BF dynamics would need another embedding map, and the small perturbations around BF would be actually the free fields, would be the Coulomb phase. Whereas this loop-com gravity embedding map which you use is very strong coupling. It actually corresponds to the strong coupling expansion.
Okay, I agree that there's an issue about this other embedding map. And I'm not sure that it is exact embedding map that might exist. You might have to generalize the notion, just as you are saying. But one can turn that the other way around now and go back to Yang-Mills theory, but in two space-time dimensions. And this was completely solved, right? And again, using loop quantum gravity kind of using spin network kind of techniques. So it will be good to see what happens using this. The relations that, I mean, this coarse-graining things that you now have.
One could do that, and since it's, I mean, the solution is kind of, Yang-Mills is quasi-topological, you can source it completely, I think, also with these methods.
Exactly. So, but it'll be good to see, because there is an issue about the boundary state and so on, which is, you know, in the other way around, one was just calculating the Wilson loop function and finding out. And that's what Thomas and a whole bunch of us did, just calculating the Wilson loop function in two dimensions using loop quantum gravity ideas. So here it will be complementary, and it will be easier perhaps than the U1 case, just because the methods, as you say, are better suited for strong coupling limit.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Other questions?
A question from Amelia.
Go ahead.
Hi, Bianca. I would like to ask if there is any explicit role for the Barberi-Minsky parameter in this procedure of coarse graining. Does the value of the Barberi-Minsky parameter influence the coarse graining?
What I explained is a general procedure. In the application, to spin forms or spin net models, we had these models which were parameterized by the simplicity constraints. And indeed, this comes with this question which I mentioned, how do simplicity constraints get coarse-grained? If one manages to basically, after coarse-graining, to truncate or to project back to the original form of the partition function, which is kind of a bit arbitrary, but in this case, you would see how your simplicity constraints change, this E function change. And for the EPL model, you know, there's just this E function depends on the gamma parameter. So with lots of approximations, you could try to approximate your gamma, your flow of the gamma parameter. In this case, however, it would be useful to do it for SU2 or at least for a big quantum group, which would be kind of hard. So for the final groups, it's, there's not a natural way to introduce a gamma parameter. So if you generalize this question, you can basically investigate how the simplicity constraints change under coarse-graining.
Yeah. Okay, this answers my question. Thank you.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Bianca again.
Thank you.